Wow, this whole idea of union with Christ that we've been diving into, it's so huge, right? I mean, it's everywhere in the New Testament, but what's really blowing my mind is how much groundwork is laid in the Old Testament, all these foundational ideas. It's like we're unearthing some hidden treasures, finding the roots of this incredibly important theological concept.
It really is fascinating. The sources you sent, especially Dr. Peterson's work, are a great guide for this kind of exploration. And you're absolutely right. Even though the exact phrase union with Christ doesn't show up in the Old Testament, all the essential pieces are there. Our mission in this deep dive is to really examine that foundation. And today we're tackling what Dr. Peterson calls Old Testament identification.
Identification. Okay, so it sounds like we're not just talking about God recognizing his people, right? We're talking about God actively setting them apart, claiming them, saying, these are mine. And in doing that, he's shaping their very identity.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And what's really interesting, this idea of identification is just the first layer of a three-part foundation, so we'll be unpacking a lot more as we go. In future deep dives, we'll explore incorporation and participation, tracing these ideas through the Old Testament, the Gospels, and Acts. But today, we're focusing specifically on how God identifies with his people in the Old Testament.
Got it. So let's dig into that. Help me understand this idea of identification a little better. Is it about God's presence so closely tied to his people that it actually defines who they are, both to God and to the world?
Exactly. It's God's presence with his people that fundamentally defines their identity in relation to him and to the world around them. And the primary way we see this unfold in the Old Testament is through, God's covenant relationship with them.
Oh, that makes sense.
And it starts right from the beginning, right? Like, think about Genesis. We're created in God's image. That's Genesis 1:27. It suggests this deep connection, this mirroring of the divine. And even after the fall, even after everything goes wrong in the garden, God's first question to Adam isn't a rebuke. It's, where are you? Genesis 3:9. It's like, in spite of the brokenness, there's this underlying desire for connection, for presence.
Absolutely. What's so remarkable is that even in the face of human rebellion, God's initiative for relationship, it doesn't just disappear. He keeps pursuing. Then we move forward in the narrative and see God specifically choosing Abram, who then becomes Abraham, and establishing a covenant with him and his descendants. You can find that in Genesis chapters 12, 15, and 17. This is a real turning point. It's God drawing a line in the sand, saying, "This is my chosen lineage, my people." And this covenant wasn't some quiet, private thing, right? It set Israel apart from every other nation around them. The source material emphasizes how God's presence through this covenant gave Israel a unique identity. They weren't just another tribe or nation, they were God's tribe.
Precisely. Their identity was rooted in their relationship with God, established through that covenant. And that's the key. It wasn't about their military power, cultural achievements, any of that. It was about their connection to God. And when we look at the New Testament, we start to see echoes of this idea, this foundational idea. Paul, in his letters, frequently addresses believers as, for example, sanctified in Christ Jesus. That's 1 Corinthians 1:2. Or it talks about the grace given you in Christ Jesus in 1 Corinthians 1:4. This identifier, this in Christ that becomes so central in the New Testament, it has its roots right here in this Old Testament understanding of God's covenant people, the ones he set apart, the ones he identified as his own.
I see. So it's like the Old Testament lays this groundwork of God identifying his people through covenant, and then the New Testament builds on that, revealing that now, for believers, that place of identification, that belonging, it's found in Christ. Okay, so we're seeing how God's presence leads to this idea of identification, but the Old Testament gives us something even more tangible to grasp this, right? The tabernacle.
You got it.
Yeah.
The instructions for the tabernacle are in Exodus 25:8 to 9, and they're really a powerful physical representation of God's desire to dwell among his people. God commands them. He says, "Build this sacred space so that my presence can be with you." It's tangible, real, concrete.
And our source, it even shares a really insightful story about a Mennonite community that actually built a replica of the tabernacle. The meticulous detail, the care they put into it, recreating it as accurately as they could based on the biblical specifications, it just highlights how much God desired to be present. And the whole system within the tabernacle, the sacrifices, the priesthood, it all pointed to a way for sinful people to approach a holy God.
That's such an important point.
Yeah.
The tabernacle wasn't just a building. It was a constant, visible reminder of God's promise. I am your God. It was a declaration of that very identification we've been talking about. Just like in Genesis 17, when God says to Abraham, "I will be God to you and to your descendants after you." The tabernacle right there among them. It was a powerful statement. God is here with his people.
Now, the concept of the covenant itself, it seems to have this fascinating two-sided aspect to it, according to what we've been reading. It's like God initiates it. It's what some scholars call monergistic, which basically means God is the one doing the primary work. But then there's this clear responsibility on the people side as well.
Right. It's a both-hand thing. God sovereignly initiates the covenant, like we see in Genesis 15. God alone, in the form of a smoking firepot and a flaming torch, passes between the divided pieces of the sacrificial animals while Abraham is asleep. It's a powerful image of God's unilateral commitment. But then once the covenant is in place, it creates this bilateral relationship. Abraham and his descendants, they have a responsibility to live in accordance with the covenant, to respond to God's initiative. God claims their whole existence, their life, family, future as his own.
And this idea, their identity being so intertwined with God's presence, it really comes into focus in the story of Moses after the golden calf incident in Exodus 33. You know, God is ready to lead them to the promised land, but he says he'll do it without his direct personal presence. And the people's reaction, they mourn.
Yeah. And their mourning, it speaks volumes. They understood instinctively that God's absence would fundamentally change who they were. But it's Moses' intercession in Exodus 33:1516 that really drives this point home. His boldness, I mean, he says to God, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. It's incredible.
And the reason he gives is so powerful. He says, for how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other person on the face of the earth? It's like, Moses understood their very identity, their unique status as God's chosen people. It was absolutely inseparable from God's presence being right there with them.
Exactly. Their identity wasn't based on anything they did, but solely on God's gracious choice to be with them. And this deep longing for God's presence, this identification through his being with them, it's foundational to understanding the New Testament.
But then we hit this big question, right? How can a perfectly holy God live in close proximity to people who are, well, constantly messing up and sinning? Leviticus 26 tackles this head on.
Yeah, it does. Leviticus 26:11-13, it talks about God setting his dwelling among them, walking among them and saying, I will be your God and you shall be my people. It seems like a contradiction, but it reveals the complexity of God's nature, how all these different aspects of his character, they work together. He's holy, he's just, but he's also overflowing with grace and love. Like the Westminster Shorter Catechism so beautifully summarizes it, God is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being. Wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. All these attributes, they exist together in perfect harmony.
So it's not that God overlooks sin, but that his commitment to the covenant, his desire for relationship, makes this dwelling possible even though people sin. And our source points out that Paul uses Leviticus 26 in 2 Corinthians 6:17. He talks about the church as the temple of the living God.
That's right. Paul's argument, his point, is that believers shouldn't form spiritual alliances with unbelievers. And it's directly connected to this Old Testament idea that God's presence signifies this unique union, this distinct identification. If God chooses to dwell with his people, that very act creates a separation, kind of inseparable connection.
Okay, so we're seeing this thread throughout the Old Testament, and then we get to the prophecy of Emmanuel in Isaiah 7:0-14. King Ahaz is looking for political alliances to save his kingdom, but God offers him a sign pointing to a much greater deliverance. A virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and he'll be called Emmanuel, which means God with us.
It's a huge declaration. It speaks to God's ultimate plan for his presence to be fully realized. King Ahaz, in his lack of faith, he rejects the immediate sign, but the promise itself remains. And Matthew 1:22-23 makes it clear, this prophecy finds its ultimate fulfillment in Jesus the Messiah. His very title, Emmanuel, encapsulates the very essence of God's presence in the most intimate and profound way imaginable.
It's like the whole Old Testament narrative is pointing towards this deeper, more intimate level of God's presence with humanity. And then in Ezekiel 37:24-28, we have this prophecy of David as their shepherd king forever, and God establishing his sanctuary permanently in their midst. It reinforces this hope, right?
Yes. Ezekiel's vision looks ahead to a future reality, an eschatological reality, where God's dwelling place will be with his people forever. He says, my dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. It's the ultimate and complete expression of that covenantal identification we've been talking about.
And we see glimpses of this throughout the whole Old Testament story. We have God walking in the Garden of Eden before the fall, and then there's that miraculous pillar of cloud by day and fire by night leading the Israelites through the wilderness. These are tangible, visible manifestations of God's desire to be with his people.
Absolutely. These historical events, they underscore this consistent thread of God's desire for intimacy with humanity. Even when people rebelled time and again, when they broke the covenant, God continued to offer his presence, providing a way back to him.
So bringing it all together, this Old Testament idea of identification, it's not just God recognizing his people. It's God actively uniting himself with them through his presence, through his covenant, and in doing so, shaping their identities, setting them apart. And this idea, it finds its ultimate and complete fulfillment in the incarnation of Jesus Christ, right? God becoming human, living among us, Emmanuel, God with us. Like John tells us in John 1.14, the word became flesh and dwelt among us, which even carries that double meaning of tabernacling.
Right.
And like Jesus himself promises in Matthew 28.20, I am with you always to the end of the age. So even though the Old Testament doesn't use the phrase union with Christ explicitly, this deep dive into identification shows us the crucial groundwork that makes that New Testament concept understandable and meaningful.
That's it. The Old Testament lays this foundation. It reveals God's unwavering commitment to identify with his people, to be present with them. And this is essential for understanding the even deeper, more intimate union we find in the New Testament through faith in Christ.
This has been such an eye-opening deep dive into the Old Testament roots of this essential Christian concept. Thinking about how central God's presence was to the identity of his people in the Old Testament, it really makes you think about what it means for us, for believers today, to be in Christ. How does understanding this historical context, this rich background, change your perspective on that core belief? And if the desire for God's presence was so strong throughout the Old Testament, what does that tell us about our own spiritual needs, about the unchanging character of God? We really encourage you to take some time to reflect on that. And please join us next time as we continue exploring the Old Testament foundations. We'll be delving into incorporation and participation, which are, let me tell you, just as fascinating.